8. Sublime Madness. The duty of a revolutionary is to always struggle, no matter what, to struggle to extinction. Auguste Blanqui, La Critique Sociale. It might be a basic characteristic of existence that those who would know it completely would perish, in which case the strength of a spirit should be measured according to how much of the truth one could still barely endure. Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. The man who waged the first significant war in North America against hydraulic fracturing, commonly known as fracking, was an eccentric messianic Christian preacher named Weibo Ludwig. Ludwig, with a small Christian community in the Canadian province of Alberta, sabotaged at least one wellhead by pouring cement down its shaft, and he blew up several others. The Canadian authorities, along with the oil and gas barons, have demonized Ludwig as an eco-terrorist, an odd charge given that they are the ones responsible for systematically destroying the environment and the planet. The anti-fracking movement, especially in rural communities in Colorado, Pennsylvania, and upstate New York, is one of the most potent grassroots insurgencies in North America. The movement has been able to block the natural gas industry's plans to exploit shale gas in New York State, and it is a huge stumbling block for the industry in many other parts of the United States and Canada. If the anti-fracking movement has a founding father, it is Weibo Ludwig. Ludwig swiftly understood that environmental laws are not designed to protect the environment. The laws are designed, at best, to regulate the environment's continued exploitation. It was futile, he argued, to spend energy attempting to improve or adjust these regulations. We might be able to slow or delay environmental degradation, but we would not stop it. Ludwig exposed the absurdity of attempting to build an environmental movement that had as its goal the more efficient oversight and regulation of the oil and gas industry. He realized that lobbying those in power, testifying in hearings, writing letters of protest, contacting celebrities to attract press attention, and organizing petition drives to get the government to intervene was useless. Corporations, he understood, determined and often wrote the laws that were ostensibly designed to regulate their activity. Environmental laws were, he found, a circular joke on the public, and the big green environmental groups that worked within these legal parameters were largely ineffectual and often complicit in the destruction of the ecosystems they claimed they wanted to protect. Resistance, he argued, would have to be militant, and it would have to be local. It could not play by the rules imposed by the corporate state. As Thomas Lindsay, the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which has helped organize dozens of communities to impose local bans on oil and gas extraction, pointed out, 40 years after the major environmental laws were adopted in the U.S. and 40 years after trying to regulate the damage caused by corporations to the natural environment and our communities, by almost every major environmental statistic, things are worse now than they were before. Calgary, Alberta is a boomtown. Glittering skyscrapers, monuments to the obscene profits amassed by a fossil fuel industry that is exploiting the tar sands and the vast oil and natural gas fields, have transformed Calgary, declaring the city's new identity as a mecca for money, dirty politics, greed, and industry jobs. The city is as soulless and sterile as Houston. The death of the planet for a few is very good business. Weibo felt that our society was in a spiritual crisis rather than an environmental or an economic crisis, David York told me. York's film Weibo's War is a portrayal of Ludwig and his fight with the oil and gas industry. He felt that our addiction to fossil fuels, rampant consumerism and materialism, addictions, breakdown of family units, were all symptoms of a society that had lost its root connection to God. Further, he felt that we are in a kind of end-time state, where the forces of good are in a terrible struggle with the forces of evil. He wasn't so crass as to put a timetable on it, but in his view, any fool can see the times. that one of our era's most effective figures of resistance against the oil and gas industry was a messianic Christian is perhaps not coincidental. He was propelled forward by a vision. I do not share Ludwig's Christian fundamentalism. His community was a rigid patriarchy. But I do share his belief that when human law comes into conflict with what is moral, human law must be defied. Ludwig grasped the moral decadence of the consumer society, its unchecked hedonism, worship of money, and deadening cult of the self. He retreated in 1985 with his small band of followers into the remoteness of northern Alberta. His community, called Trickle Creek, was equipped with its own biodiesel refinery, windmill, and solar panels, which permitted it to produce its own power, as well as a greenhouse and a mill. Its members, who grew their own food, severed themselves from the contaminants of consumer culture. But like the struggle of Axel Heist, the protagonist in Joseph Conrad's novel Victory, Ludwig's flight from evil resulted in evil coming to him. Ludwig's farm was atop one of the largest oil and gas reserves in the world. Landowners in Alberta only own the top 6 inches of soil. The mineral rights below it belong to the state. The province can lease these rights without the knowledge or acquiescence of the owner. Beneath Ludwig's farm lay a fossil fuel known as sour gas, a neurotoxin that, if released from within the earth, even in small amounts, can poison livestock, water tables, and people. Wherever a man goes, men will pursue and paw him with their dirty institutions, wrote Henry David Thoreau. This is what happened to Ludwig. The oil and gas companies began a massive drilling effort in the early 1990s. At first, like many other reformers and activists, Ludwig used legal and political channels to push back against the companies, which were putting down wells on the edge of his 160-acre farm. He spent the first 5 years attending hearings with civil regulators, writing letters. He even wrote to Jane Fonda, and appealing in vain to elected officials, government agencies, the press, environmentalists, and First Nations groups. His family, he had 11 children, posted a sign in 1990 that decried the ruthless interruption and cessation of privacy, the relentless, greedy grabbing of creational resources, the calloused disregard for the sanctity of the Lord's Day, the legislation of land and mineral ownership policy that does violence to the God-given right to property. Ludwig then presented the offending oil company, Ranchmans, with a bill for the sign. He was primarily motivated by his love for his family and a strong sense of justice, said Andrew Nikiforuk, the author of a book on Ludwig called Saboteurs, Weibo Ludwig's War Against Big Oil, whom I met in Calgary. He told me, it did not seem right to him that the oil industry could park a drilling well for sour gas in view of his family's communal dining room. Is a man not even master in his own house, let alone his own land, on matters like these? His war against industry illustrated the cost of our addiction to hydrocarbons. Our materialistic way of life is based on the destruction of groundwater, the devaluing of rural property, the invasion of rural communities, the poisoning of skies with carcinogens, the fragmentation of landscapes, Nikiforuk said. Urban people do not understand the sacrifices now being imposed on rural people. Ludwig's first acts of sabotage, as Nikiforuk's book and York's film document, were minor. He laid down nails poking up out of boards on roads to puncture the tires on the industry's trucks. He smashed solar panels. He blocked roads by downing trees. He disabled vehicles and drilling equipment. But after 2 leaks of hydrogen sulfide sour gas from nearby wells, which forced everyone on the farm to evacuate, and were followed by numerous farm animals giving birth to deformed or stillborn offspring, as well as 5 human miscarriages or stillbirths within Ludwig's community, and after the destruction of 2 of his water wells, he declared open war on the oil and gas industry. He began to blow up oil and gas facilities. He said he had to fight back to protect his children. The Canadian Mounted Police, accompanied by private security agents hired by the oil companies, spent millions to investigate and halt the sabotage. Ludwig's farm was occupied by police five times and searched for incriminating evidence. The police and Ancana Corporation infiltrated Ludwig's tight community with an agent provocateur who, to prove he could be trusted, blew up a well owned by what was then Alberta Energy Corporation, now Ancana. Ludwig was blamed for the explosion. The oil company also brought in a terrorism expert from Toronto to speak at local town hall gatherings. York filmed one of the talks, and the expert warned residents of the rising terrorism of religious cults led by fanatic, charismatic leaders. Ludwig was undeterred. "People are talking here that maybe someone should be shooting guys in pinstripe suits to get them to stop," he said. Ludwig, whose intimate knowledge of the Albertan terrain allow him to outfox hundreds of police officers, was never caught in an act of sabotage, but he probably had a hand in damage to hundreds of remote well sites estimated at $12 million. The federal government in Ottawa, in desperation, considered sending in the army. Ludwig was finally arrested in 2000 on 5 counts of property damage and possession of explosives and imprisoned for 19 months. He spent his time in prison reading a treatise in Dutch, he was fluent, on the nature of hell. He referred to the biblical tale of David and Goliath and quoted Sun Tzu's The Art of War to justify his struggle against colossal corporate power, saying, "The war is won before it is fought." Ludwig believed that if you fought for righteousness, you would always be assured of spiritual victory, even if you were defeated in the eyes of the world. "It's not size," he said. "It's whether a man is right or not. The fight is won on principle." In his home, he kept a poster of activist and journalist Ken Sarowiwa, a Nigerian hanged in 1995 after he campaigned against Shell Oil's exploitation of his country. The poster read, "The environment is man's first right. Without a clean environment, man cannot exist to claim other rights, be they political, social, or economic." Ludwig once invited visiting civil servants who worked for oil and gas regulators to dinner. He fed them homemade cheeses, preserves, jams, and wild cranberry wine. The pièce de résistance, which Ludwig unveiled with his usual flair, was the skull of a horse killed by sour gas. "It's just a symbol of all the death we've had around here," he informed his startled guests. On another occasion, he dumped noxious sour crude on the carpet in the office of local regulators to see if it bothered them. The sabotage did not end with Ludwig's death in 2012. There are periodic reports of ongoing sabotage along the path of the XL pipeline and in the Alberta oil fields. I'd also say that sabotage in the oil patch is one of the oil and gas industry's dirty little secrets, York said. It is widespread, and to many landowners, it is a natural consequence of the industry's attitudes and behavior to those whose land they are occupying. The industry doesn't make a big fuss because they don't want to encourage the response. But violence begets violence, and the more facilities Ludwig blew up, the harsher became the intrusion of the state. Meeting industrial violence against livestock and families with more industrial violence against oil and gas installations is not the answer, said Nikki Foruk. It is an act of frustration as well as a reflection of the captured state of regulators, and it submits an entire community to a reign of industry and state-sanctioned terror. A second war broke out in the bush in the 2000s during an intense period of hydraulic fracking. 6 bombings occurred at Encana well sites in northern British Columbia, just 50 kilometers from Ludwig's farm. The government sent in 250 officers to investigate. They treated rural citizens like members of the Taliban. The campaign ended as mysteriously as it began and had all the earmarks of Ludwig. It did not change industry practices. Ludwig's gravest mistake was his decision, or the decision of someone in his small community, to shoot at 2 trucks carrying rowdy teenagers. The sons and daughters of oil and gas workers roared through the group's compound at about 4 a.m. on June 20, 1999. Carmen Willis, a 16-year-old girl, was fatally shot by someone on the farm, and a second teenager survived a wound. York, in his film, shows Ludwig family members repeating like automatons that they thought they were under attack because the backfiring of the vehicles sounded like gunshots. No one on the farm took responsibility for the shooting. No one was charged. But after the killing of the girl, most of those in the area refused to associate with Ludwig and his community. Local businesses put up signs that read, "No service for Ludwigs." Ludwig, before he died at age 70, after refusing chemotherapy for esophageal cancer, denounced violence. With his family, he had read Jacques Ellul's 1969 book, Violence, Reflections from a Christian Perspective. Ellul, like Ludwig's Dutch father, had been part of the resistance against the Nazis in World War II. What constantly marked the life of Jesus was not nonviolence, but in every situation, the choice not to use power, Ellul writes in What I Believe. This is infinitely different. The Christian should participate in social and political efforts in order to have an influence in the world, Ellul argues in The Presence of the Kingdom, not with the hope of making a paradise of the earth, but simply to make it more tolerable. Not to diminish the opposition between this world and the kingdom of God, but simply to modify the opposition between the disorder of this world and the order of preservation that God wants it to have. Not to bring in the kingdom of God, but so that the gospel might be proclaimed in order that all men might truly hear the good news. We feel weak in all the things we are fighting, Ludwig reflected. I think the match is very unequal. But it's all right. Instead of griping about it, we might as well give ourselves to it. The battle with the corporate state will take place not only in city streets and plazas, but in the nation's heartland. Ranchers, farmers, and enraged citizens, often after seeing their land seized by eminent domain and their water supplies placed under mortal threat, have united with activists to oppose fracking and the building of the Keystone XL tar sand pipeline. The Tar Sands Blockade, TSB, which is working to stop the northern leg of the Keystone XL from being built, is an example of this grassroots movement. The centers of resistance it has set up in Texas and Oklahoma and on tribal lands along the proposed route of this six-state, 1,700-mile proposed pipeline are fast becoming flashpoints. The XL pipeline, which would cost $7 billion and whose southern portion is complete, is a symbol of the dying order. If the northern section is built, it will pump 830,000 barrels a day of unrefined tar sand fluid from tar sand mine fields in Canada to the Texas Gulf Coast. Tar sand oil is not conventional crude oil. It is a synthetic slurry that, because tar sand oil is solid in its natural state, cannot flow without being laced with toxic chemicals and gas condensates. Tar sands are boiled and diluted with these chemicals before being blasted down a pipeline at high pressure. Water sources are instantly contaminated if there is a rupture. The pipeline, if built, would cross nearly 2,000 U.S. waterways, including the Ogallala Aquifer, source of one-third of U.S. farmland irrigation water. And it is not a matter of if, but when it would spill. TransCanada's Keystone One pipeline, built in 2010, spilled 14 times in its first 12 months of operation. Because the extraction process emits such a large quantity of greenhouse gases, the pipeline has been called the fuse to the largest carbon bomb on the planet. The climate scientist James Hansen warns that successful completion of the pipeline, along with the exploitation of Canadian tar sands it would facilitate, would mean game over for the climate. Keystone XL is part of the final phase of extreme exploitation by the corporate state. The corporations intend to squeeze the last vestiges of profit from an ecosystem careening toward collapse. Most of the oil that can be reached through drilling from traditional rigs is depleted. In response, the fossil fuel industry has developed new technologies to go after dirtier, less efficient forms of energy. These technologies bring with them a dramatically heightened cost to ecosystems. They accelerate the warming of the planet and contaminate vital water sources. Deep water Arctic drilling, tar sand extraction, hydraulic fracturing, or hydrofracking, and drilling horizontally, given the cost of extraction and the effects on the environment, amount to ecological suicide. The pipeline has attracted construction crews and rebels alike. Surviving on canned food and bottled water, protesters carried out tree sits in September 2012 to block the path of the pipeline near Winnsboro, Texas. Others chained themselves to logging equipment, locked themselves in trucks carrying pipe to construction sites, and hung banners at equipment staging areas. Doug Grant, a former Exxon employee, was arrested outside Winnsboro when he bound himself to clear-cutting machinery. Shannon Beebe and Benjamin Franklin, after handcuffing themselves to equipment being used to cut down trees, were tasered, pepper-sprayed, and physically assaulted by local police, reportedly at the request of TransCanada officials. The actor Daryl Hannah and a 78-year-old East Texas great-grandmother and farmer, Eleanor Fairchild, were arrested on October 4, 2012, while blocking TransCanada bulldozers on Fairchild's property. The Fairchild Farm, like other properties seized by TransCanada, was taken under Texas eminent domain laws on behalf of a foreign corporation. At the same time, private security companies employed by TransCanada, along with local law enforcement, aggressively detained and restricted reporters, including a New York Times reporter and photographer, who were attempting to cover the protests. Most of the journalists were on private property, with the permission of the landowners. I reached climate activist Tom Weiss nearly 1,000 miles from the southern blockade in Colorado. Weiss was pedaling up and down the Front Range, hand-delivering copies of an open letter that activists had sent to the president. Weiss had been joined in his protests and rallies by indigenous leaders, including Tom Poorbear, vice president of Oglala Lakota Nation, and in Denver by members of the Occupy Denver community. In 2011, Weiss had ridden his bright yellow rocket trike, a recumbent tricycle wrapped in a lightweight aerodynamic shell, for 10 weeks and 2,150 miles along the proposed Keystone XL pipeline route. Keystone XL is being built as an export pipeline for Canada to sell its dirty oil to foreign markets, he said when we spoke by phone. This is not about energy security. It's about securing TransCanada's profits. Wes cited the conclusion of a report by the Global Labor Institute at Cornell University that the jobs estimates put forward by TransCanada are unsubstantiated, and that the project could actually destroy more jobs than it creates. Local resistance along the proposed pipeline has grown, especially as the project has begun to be put in place. And there have been reports of sabotage along the pipeline route. Activists dump salt into the gas tanks, slash the tires of construction equipment, and disable equipment, said a pipeline activist based in Houston who did not want to give her name. The companies don't want to talk about it because they fear the sabotage will grow if it is publicized. We can't talk about it openly because we will be arrested. If completed, the House of Representatives passed a Senate bill that authorized construction of the northern leg of the pipeline in February 2015. The 485-mile southern leg from Cushing, Oklahoma to Nederland, Texas, would slice through major waterways that include the Neches, Red, Angelina, and Sabine Rivers, as well as the Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer, which provides drinking water for some 10 million Texans. The invasive extraction of tar sands and shale deposits, and the deep-sea drilling in the Arctic, Alaska, and the Gulf of Mexico, and on the eastern seaboard, have been sold to the U.S. public as a route to energy independence, a way to create tens of thousands of new jobs, and a boost to the sagging economy. But this is another corporate lie. The process of extracting shale oil through hydraulic fracking requires millions of gallons of chemically treated water that leaves behind poisoned aquifers and huge impoundment ponds of toxic waste. Extracting oil shale or kerogen for melting requires expending tremendous amounts of energy for a marginal return. It also involves vast open-pit mining operations and pumping underground that melts the oil with steam jets. Tar sand extraction, because it emits significantly more greenhouse gases than conventional oil drilling, will accelerate global warming. Weiss said that he saw the struggle to halt the Keystone XL pipeline as a symbolic crossroads for the country and the planet. One path leads, he said, toward decay, and the other toward renewal. There comes a time when we must make a stand for the future of our children and for all life on Earth, he said. That time is here. That time is now. Reinhold Niebuhr wrote that those who defy the forces of injustice and repression are possessed by a sublime madness in the soul, which disregards immediate appearances and emphasizes profound and ultimate unities. Niebuhr noted that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism is a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr wrote in The New Republic, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Abraham Heschel notes, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. Because he sees and faces an unpleasant reality, the prophet is compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his heart expected. It is impossible to defy radical evil, a phrase originally coined by Immanuel Kant to describe those who surrender their freedom and morality to an extreme form of self-adulation and later adopted by Hannah Arendt to describe totalitarianism, without sublime madness. Sublime madness demands self-sacrifice and entails the very real possibility of death. Not that the rebel possessed of sublime madness wants to die, for the fight against radical evil is the ultimate affirmation of life. The rebel understands the terrible power of the forces arrayed against all rebels, and how far these forces, once threatened, will go to silence rebels, and yet is so possessed that he or she is unable to conform. The rebel, dismissed as impractical and zealous, is chronically misunderstood. Those cursed with timidity, fear, or blindness, and those who are slaves to opportunism call for moderation and patience. They distort the language of religion, spirituality, compromise, generosity, and compassion to justify cooperation with systems of power that are bent on our destruction. The rebel is deaf to these critiques. The rebel hears only his or her inner voice, which demands steadfast defiance. Self-promotion, positions of influence, the adulation of the public, and the awards and prominent positions that come with bowing before authority mean nothing to the rebel, who understands that virtue is not rewarded. The rebel expects nothing and gets nothing. But for the rebel, to refuse to struggle, to refuse to rebel, is to commit spiritual and moral suicide. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Václav Havel said when he stood up to the communist regime in Czechoslovakia. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He is not seeking power. He has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He does not attempt to charm the public. He offers nothing and promises nothing. He can offer, if anything, only his own skin, and he offers it solely because he has no other way of affirming the truth he stands for. His actions simply articulate his dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The rebel, possessed of sublime madness, speaks words that resonate only with those who can see through the facade. The rebel functions as a prophet. He or she has what Leo Tolstoy described as the three characteristics of prophecy. First, It is entirely opposed to the general ideas of the people in the midst of whom it is uttered. Second, all who hear it feel its truth. And thirdly, above all, it urges men to realize what it foretells. The message of the rebel is disturbing because of the consequences of the truth he or she speaks. To accept that Barack Obama is, as Cornel West says, a black mascot for Wall Street means having to challenge some frightening monoliths of power and give up the comfortable illusion that the Democratic Party or liberal institutions or a single elected official can be instruments for genuine reform. To accept that nearly all forms of electronic communication are captured and stored by the government is to give up the illusion of freedom. The rebel, by disseminating this truth, forces us to embrace a new radicalism. The rebel shows us that there is no hope for correction or reversal by appealing to power. The rebel makes it clear that it is only by overthrowing traditional systems of power that we can be liberated. The denunciation of the rebel is a matter of self-preservation for the liberal class. For once the callous heart of the corporate state is exposed, so is the callous heart of its liberal apologists. And the rebel, who has few friends, is the constant target of the liberal establishment. Socrates, for this reason, is reported by some ancient accounts to have stood mute when he was being tried for sedition and condemned to death. Plato, however, has Socrates defend himself in the Apology. Socrates's judges could not grasp the inner compulsion, the sublime madness, that drove Socrates to risk his life for the truth. They failed to grasp the central Socratic paradox, that it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. Socrates's call for individuals to eschew the claims of society and the state on the citizen, like the rebellions of Assange, Abu Jamal, Manning, and Snowden, was a form of civic heresy. His demand that we do what is right for its own sake, not for the sake of the polis or others, and not because we adhere to a particular moral or religious code, made no sense to those confined by law. Because he saw the political system in Athens as ignorant and morally bankrupt, he said that it was impossible for a good person to participate in the charade of justice it perpetrated. And for speaking this truth, for challenging the legitimacy of a decadent system, he was sentenced to die, charged with corrupting the morals of Athenian youth. Socrates tells Callicles in the Gorgias, in the Dialogues of Plato, that if he is put on trial, this is the reason why he will be bereft of an effective defense. I'll be judged like a doctor tried before a jury of children on charges brought by a pastry cook. Children, the defendant here has done many bad things to you. He corrupts the youngest among you by cutting and burning. He reduces them to perplexity by drying them out and stewing them, prescribing the most bitter potions, compelling hunger and thirst. Nor does he entertain you as I do with all kinds of delicious treats. What do you think a doctor caught up in this evil could say? If he told the truth, if he said, "Children, I did do all these things, and for your health," how great do you think the outcry from such judges would be? A pretty big one? Socrates goes on, "I know that if I am brought into court, it will be the same with me. I will not be able to tell them of the pleasure I provided, the things they consider kindness and benefits, and I envy neither those who provide them nor those for whom they are provided. If someone accuses me of corrupting the youth by reducing them to perplexity, or of abusing their elders with sharp and pointed speech, in public or private, I won't be able to tell the truth, which is, I say all these things justly, gentlemen and judges, and do so for your benefit. Nor will I be able to say anything else. The result, no doubt, will be that I'll take whatever comes." Martin Luther King Jr.'s life was marked by this Socratic paradox. Christian theology calls the Socratic defiance of radical evil bearing the cross. And Christian theology warns that all those who are successful in their defiance pay a bitter price. "When I took up the cross," King said less than a year before he was killed, "I recognized its meaning. The cross is something that you bear, and ultimately that you die on." Or as King told a church congregation in Atlanta, I choose to identify with the underprivileged. I choose to identify with the poor. I choose to give my life for the hungry. I choose to give my life for those who have been left out of the sunlight of opportunity. I choose to live for and with those who find themselves seeing life as a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. This is the way I am going. If it means suffering a little bit, I'm going that way. If it means sacrificing, I'm going that way. If it means dying for them, I'm going that way, because I heard a voice saying, "Do something for others." The moral life, celebrated only in the afterglow of history, and often not celebrated at all, is lonely, frightening, and hard. The crowd condemns you. The state brands you a traitor. You struggle with your own fears and doubts. The words you speak are often not understood, and you are never certain if your words and actions in the end will make any difference. The rebel knows the odds. To defy radical evil does not mean to be irrational. It is to have a sober clarity about the power of evil and one's insignificance, and yet to rebel anyway. To face radical evil is to accept self-sacrifice. Herman Melville's Captain Ahab and John Milton's Satan in Paradise Lost, like Marek Edelman, shared these qualities of sublime madness. They understood the strength of divine power, which they saw as malevolent, yet pitted themselves against it. It is those possessed by sublime madness who keep alive another way of being. W. H. Auden captured the solitude and even futility of such a life at the end of his poem, September 1, 1939. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. I traveled to the Swiss village of Bignon, outside Geneva, shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989, to see Axel von dem Busche. He was a former Wehrmacht major, holder of the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross for extreme battlefield bravery, 3 times wounded in World War II, and one of the last surviving members of the inner circle of German army officers who attempted to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Resistance to Nazism was painfully rare, even as Germany was losing the war. The slightest whisper of dissent could mean death, as evidenced by the execution of the 5 Munich University students and their philosophy professor, who were members of the White Rose resistance movement. The White Rose distributed thousands of anti-Nazi leaflets before they were arrested by the Gestapo and guillotined. The text of their 6th and final set of leaflets was smuggled out of Germany by the resistance leader Helmut James Graf von Moltke, who was hanged by the Nazis in January 1945. Copies of the leaflets were dropped over Germany by Allied planes in 1943. The White Rose has been lionized by post-war Germans. One of its members, Alexander Schmorell, was made a saint by the Russian Orthodox Church, and squares and schools in Germany are named for the resistors. But in a BBC interview, Lieselotte Fürst-Ramdohr, a member of the group who was arrested but released by the Nazis, said that the resistors had little support among the public during the war. "At the time, they'd have had us all executed," said Fürst-Ramdohr, who hid leaflets for the group and helped make the stencils they used to paint slogans on walls. History has vindicated resistance groups such as the White Rose and plotters such as von dem Busche. But they were desperately alone while they defied the law, their oaths of allegiance, and public opinion. Von dem Busche said that even after the war he was spat upon as he walked down city streets in Germany. Rebellion, when it begins, is not legal, safe, comfortable, or popular. Somebody, after all, had to make a start. One of the White Rose members, Sophie Scholl, said on February 22, 1943, at her trial in a Nazi court, "What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just don't dare express themselves as we did." Von dem Busche, who died in 1993, took part as a 20-year-old lieutenant in the invasions of Belgium, Luxembourg, France, where a French sniper shot off his right thumb and he was wounded in the shoulder, and Poland. He was stationed after the invasion of Poland in the town of Dubno in the western Ukraine. His military unit was ordered to secure an abandoned airbase. The young officer watched as the SS escorted some 2,000 Jews to the airfield. The Jews were trucked in from the surrounding countryside, stripped and forced by the black uniformed officers toward long, deep trenches, von dem Busche told me. They were shot in their heads by an SS officer with a machine pistol, and then the next row was made to lie down and shot in their heads. It is not an easy memory to live with, especially as I considered myself, as an officer of the German army, to be an accessory to these murders. It was then that he decided to defy Hitler. But it would not be until 1943, when it was clear that the Germans were losing the war, that he and a small group of other officers led by Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg began to plot to assassinate the Nazi leader. The conspirators did not defy the Nazis on behalf of the Jews, von dem Busche conceded, but to save the country from defeat, dismemberment, and catastrophe. One motive, along with just stopping the killing, was the most valid, to stop the Russians east of Poland, he said of the plotters. If we had managed to keep the Russians out, Europe would have been spared the division and pain of the last 44 years. In 1943, von dem Busche was a captain. He was asked to model the army's new winter coat for Hitler at the Wolfschanze, the Nazi leader's headquarters in East Prussia. He and von Stauffenberg managed to obtain fuses and plastic explosives from the British so that they could avoid the noise made by German fuses, which hissed when lit. Von dem Busche also had two hand grenades. He planned to physically seize Hitler and ignite the grenades in a suicide mission intended to kill the Führer and perhaps other high-ranking Nazi officials in the room. The code name for the operation was Overcoat. Von dem Busche said that von Stauffenberg told him, "I am committing high treason with all my might and means," but added that under natural law, the plotters had a duty to use violence to defend the innocent from the horrific crimes of the state. Von dem Busche was summoned to Hitler's headquarters in November 1943. He waited for 3 days, about 10 miles away, rarely leaving his room. He woke up every morning and wondered, he said, if he would be alive in the evening, and if my nerve would hold. But the train carrying the winter uniforms was bombed by Allied warplanes, and von dem Busche was sent back to the Russian front, where he lost a leg in the bitter fighting. Von dem Busche, 6 feet 5 inches tall, with cobalt blue eyes and a voice that rumbled like a freight train, refused to describe what he or the other plotters did as heroism. He detested words like honor and glory being applied to warfare. He had no time for those who romanticized combat. He had no option as a human being but to resist, he said, and acted as Edelman did, to save his self-esteem. There was no hero stuff involved, none at all, he said. I thought this was an adequate means to balance out what I had seen. I felt this was justifiable homicide and was the only means to stop mass murder inside and outside Germany. His was the 10th thwarted attempt on Hitler's life. There would be one more. On July 20, 1944, von Stauffenberg carried 2 small bombs in a briefcase to a meeting with Hitler. He struggled before the meeting to arm the bombs with pliers, a difficult task as he had lost his right hand and had only 3 fingers on his left hand after being wounded in North Africa. He managed to arm only 1 bomb. After placing the briefcase with a bomb under the table near Hitler, he left the room. Von Stauffenberg was outside at the time of the explosion, which killed 4 people, including Hitler's security double, but only slightly wounded Hitler, who was shielded by a table leg. Nazi propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels announced over the radio that Hitler had survived. Hitler spoke to the nation not long afterward. Von Stauffenberg and other conspirators were captured and executed by a firing squad. Von dem Busche, recovering from the loss of his leg in a Waffen-SS hospital outside Berlin, anxiously followed the news of the assassination attempt on the radio. He listened to Hitler's angry tirade against the traitors who had attempted to kill him. He knew it would not be long before the SS appeared at his bedside. He spent the night eating page after page of his address book, which had the names of every major conspirator who was being hunted, was under arrest, or was dead. The British explosive material from his aborted suicide bombing was in a suitcase under his bed. He asked another officer to carry the suitcase out of the hospital and toss it into a lake. He was repeatedly interrogated over the next few days, but because none of the other plotters had implicated him, even under torture, he managed to elude their fate. He did not succeed, at least not in killing Hitler and overthrowing the Nazis. He felt that as an army officer, even with his involvement in the assassination plots, he remained part of the murderous apparatus that had unleashed indefensible suffering and death. He worried that he had not done enough. The brutality and senselessness of the war haunted him. The German public's enthusiastic collusion with the Nazi regime tormented him, and the ghosts of the dead, including those he admired, never left him. He understood, as we must, that to do nothing in a time of radical evil is to be complicit. "I should have taken off my uniform in the Ukraine," he told me on the last afternoon of my visit, "and joined the line of Jews to be shot." Those with sublime madness accept the possibility of their own death as the price paid for defending life. This curious mixture of gloom and hope, of defiance and resignation, of absurdity and meaning, is born of the rebel's awareness of the enormity of the forces that must be defeated and the remote chances for success. "Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism," Havel wrote. "It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out." Optimism, especially the naive optimism fed to us by the corporate state, engenders self-delusion and passivity, and is the opposite of hope. Rebels who are self-aware, who are possessed of sublime madness, are often plagued by a gnawing despair. When the movie producer Abby Mann, who wanted to film Martin Luther King's life story, asked King facetiously, "How does the movie end?" King responded, "It ends with me getting killed." As Mann recalled, "I looked at him. He was smiling, but he wasn't joking." Social and economic life will again have to be rationed and shared. The lusts of capitalism will have to be curtailed or destroyed. And there will have to be a recovery of reverence for the sacred, the bedrock of pre-modern society, so we can see each other and the earth not as objects to exploit, but as living beings to be revered and protected. This recovery will require a very different vision for human society. William Shakespeare lamented the loss of the medieval Catholic rituals eradicated by the Reformation. When Shakespeare was a boy, the critic Harold Goddard pointed out, he experienced the religious pageants, morality plays, church festivals, cycle plays, feast and saints' days, displays of relics, bawdy May Day celebrations, and tales of miracles. The Puritans, the ideological vanguard of the technological order, made war on the Elizabethan and Jacobean theaters for celebrating these pre-modern practices. The London authorities in 1596 prohibited the public presentation of plays within city limits. The theaters had to relocate to the south side of the River Thames. The Puritans, in power under Cromwell in 1642, closed the London theaters and in 1644 tore down Shakespeare's Globe Theater. Within 4 years, all theaters in and around London had been destroyed. The Puritans understood, in a way that is perhaps lost to us today, that Shakespeare was attacking the cold ethic of modernity and capitalism. Shakespeare portrays the tension between the dying ethic of the pre-modern and the modern, a theme that would be explored by William Faulkner in American fiction. Shakespeare, like Faulkner, saw the rise of the modern as dangerous. The pre-modern reserved a place in the cosmos for human imagination, what the poet John Milton called things invisible to mortal sight. The new modern Machiavellian ethic of self-promotion, manipulation, bureaucracy, and deceit, personified by Iago, Richard III, and Lady Macbeth, deforms human beings and society. Shakespeare lived during a moment when the modern world, whose technology allowed it to acquire weapons of such unrivaled force that it could conquer whole empires, including the Americas and later China, instilled this new secular religion through violence. He feared its demonic power. Prospero, in Shakespeare's The Tempest, is a master of a magical island where he has absolute power. He keeps the primitive Caliban and the spirit Ariel as his slaves. Shakespeare reminds us that the power unleashed in the wilderness can prompt us to good if we honor the sacred, but to monstrous evil if we do not. There are few constraints in the wilderness, a theme that would later be explored by the novelist Joseph Conrad. The imagination triumphs in The Tempest because those who are bound to their senses and lusts are subjugated and Ariel is freed from enslavement. But in the Spanish, French, and British colonies in the Americas, as Shakespeare had seen, the lust for power and wealth, embodied by the evil dukes of the world, led to an orgy of looting, subjugation, and genocide. Imagination, as Shakespeare scholar Harold Goddard writes, is neither the language of nature nor the language of man, but both at once, the medium of communion between the two, as if the birds, unable to understand the speech of man, and man, unable to understand the songs of birds, yet longing to communicate, were to agree on a tongue made up of sounds they both could comprehend. The voice of running water, perhaps, or the wind in the trees. Imagination is the elemental speech in all senses, the first and the last, of primitive man and of the poets. In the presence of the natural world, all of the great visionaries have heard it speak to them. It spoke to Shakespeare, as it spoke to Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. This communion blurs the lines between the self and the world. It is what Percy Shelley meant when he wrote that poetry lifts the veil from the hidden beauty of the world and makes familiar things as if they were not familiar. Too often this wisdom comes too late, as it does when Othello stands contrite and broken over the dead Desdemona, or when Lear lifts up his murdered daughter Cordelia. This wisdom makes grace and transformation possible. In the kind of visions that were experienced by black elk and revered by Native Americans, the kind that inspire artists and rebels, the visionary encounters the strange, unexplainable, mysterious forces that define life. And visionary language speaks as poets and rebels do, only in abstractions and allegory. It is the language of sublime madness. The Lord at Delphi, says Heraclitus, neither speaks nor conceals, but gives a sign, writes Goddard. Dreams have the same Delphic characteristic. So does poetry. To our age, anything Delphic is anathema. We want the definite. As certainly as ours is a time of the expert and the technician, we are living under a dynasty of the intellect, and the aim of the intellect is not to wonder and love and grow wise about life, but to control it. The subservience of so much of our science to invention is the proof of this. We want the facts for the practical use we can make of them. Black Elk expressed the power and importance of the reality of human existence that lies beyond articulation. Also, as I lay there thinking of my vision, I could see it all again and feel the meaning with a part of me like a strange power glowing in my body, he said. But when the part of me that talks would try to make words for the meaning, it would be like fog and get away from me. Chants, work songs, spirituals, the blues, poetry, dance, and art converge under slavery to nourish and sustain the imagination. For the art, the blues, the spirituals, the jazz, the dance, was what we had in place of freedom, Ralph Ellison wrote. It was sublime madness that permitted African Americans, such as Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and Fannie Lou Hamer, to resist during slavery and Jim Crow. It was sublime madness that sustained the defiance of Sitting Bull and Black Elk as their land was seized, their people were slaughtered, and their cultures and means of existence were decimated. The oppressed, for they know their fate, would be the first to admit that on a rational level, it is absurd to think that it is only through the imagination that they survive, but they also know that it is true. It was sublime madness that allowed the survivors in the Nazi death camps to hold on to the sacred. Jewish inmates in Auschwitz reportedly put God on trial for the Holocaust. They condemned God to death. A rabbi stood after the guilty verdict to lead the evening prayers. African Americans and Native Americans for centuries had little control over their destinies. Forces of bigotry and violence kept them subjugated. The suffering of the oppressed was tangible, and death was a constant companion. And it was only their imagination, as William Faulkner notes at the end of The Sound and the Fury, that permitted them, unlike the novel's White Compson family, which self-destructed, to endure. The theologian James H. Cohn, who stresses the importance of Niebuhr's sublime madness for all those who resist oppression, captures this in his book The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Cohn says that for oppressed blacks, the cross is a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system with the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be the first and the first last. Cohn continues, that God could make a way out of no way in Jesus' cross was truly absurd to the intellect, yet profoundly real in the souls of black folk. Enslaved blacks who first heard the gospel message seized on the power of the cross. Christ crucified manifested God's loving and liberating presence in the contradictions of black life, that transcendent presence in the lives of black Christians that empowered them to believe that ultimately, in God's eschatological future, they would not be defeated by the troubles of this world, no matter how great and painful their suffering. Believing this paradox, this absurd claim of faith, was only possible through God's amazing grace and the gift of faith, grounded in humility and repentance. There was no place for the proud and the mighty, for people who think that God called them to rule over others. The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat. Primo Levi, in his memoir Survival in Auschwitz, writes of teaching Italian to another inmate, Jean Samuel, in exchange for lessons in French. Levi recited to Samuel, from memory, fragments of Canto 26 of Dante's The Inferno. It is the story of Ulysses' doomed final voyage. Levi writes that as he recited the lines, it was as if I also was hearing it for the first time, like the blast of a trumpet, like the voice of God. For a moment I forgot who I am and where I am. And three times round she went in roaring smother, with all the waters, at the fourth the poop, rose and the prow went down as pleased another, and over our head the hollow seas closed up. He has received the message, Levi writes of his friend, and what they shared in Dante, he has felt that it has to do with him, that it has to do with all men who toil, and with us in particular. Levi goes on, it is vitally necessary and urgent that he listen, that he understand, before it is too late. Tomorrow, he or I might be dead, or we might never see each other again. It was sublime madness that let bluesman Ishman Bracey in Hinds County, Mississippi, sing, I've been down so long, Lord, down don't worry me. And yet, in the midst of this despair, also lies the absurdity and certainty of justice. I feel my hell arisin', arisin' every day. I feel my hell arisin', arisin' every day. Some day it'll burst this levee and wash the whole wide world away. King Lear, who after suffering and affliction is finally able to see, warns us that unbridled human passion and unchecked hubris spell the suicide of the species. It will come, Albany says in King Lear, humanity must perforce prey on itself, like monsters of the deep. The human imagination, as Emma Goldman pointed out, has the power to make ideas felt. Goldman noted that when Andrew Undershaft, a character in George Bernard Shaw's play Major Barbara, says that poverty is the worst of crimes, and all the other crimes are virtues beside it, his impassioned declaration elucidates the cruelty of class warfare more effectively than Shaw's socialist tracts. It was the poems of Federico Garcia Lorca that sustained the Republicans fighting the fascists in Spain. Covering the war in El Salvador, I saw that the rebel units often traveled with musicians and theater troupes. Culture, real culture, is radical and transformative. Culture can express what lies deep within us and give words to our reality. Making us feel as well as see, culture allows us to empathize with those who are different or oppressed. Even as it reveals what is happening around us, it honors mystery. It saves us from ourselves. The role of the artist, then, precisely, is to illuminate that darkness, blaze roads through the vast forest, Baldwin writes, so that we will not, in all our doing, lose sight of its purpose, which is, after all, to make the world a more human dwelling place. Ultimately, the artist and the revolutionary function as they function and pay whatever dues they must pay behind it because they are both possessed by a vision, and they do not so much follow this vision as find themselves driven by it, writes Baldwin. Otherwise, they could never endure, much less embrace, the lives they are compelled to lead. Rebellion requires an emotional intelligence. It requires empathy and love. It requires self-sacrifice. It requires the honoring of the sacred. It requires an understanding that, as with the heroes in classical Greece, one cannot finally overcome fate or fortuna, but that we must resist regardless. Ours is a time that would have sent the Greeks to their oracles, Goddard writes. We fail at our own peril to consult our own. The people noticed that Crazy Horse was queerer than ever, Black Elk says in Black Elk Speaks, remembering the great Oglala Lakota warrior in the final days of the wars of Western expansion. He hardly ever stayed in the camp. People would find him out alone in the cold, and they would ask him to come home with them. He would not come, but sometimes he would tell the people what to do. People wondered if he ate anything at all. Once my father found him out alone like that, and he said to my father, "Uncle, you have noticed me the way I act. But do not worry. There are caves and holes for me to live in, and out here the spirits may help me. I am making plans for the good of my people." I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I do know that these corporate forces have us by the throat. And they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And this is a fight that, in the face of the overwhelming forces against us, requires that we follow those possessed by sublime madness, that we become stone catchers and find in acts of rebellion the sparks of life, an intrinsic meaning that lies outside the possibility of success. We must grasp the harshness of reality at the same time as we refuse to allow this reality to paralyze us. People of all creeds and people of no creeds must make an absurd leap of faith to believe, despite all the empirical evidence around us, that the good draws to it the good. The fight for life goes somewhere. The Buddhists call it karma. And in these acts, we make possible a better world, even if we cannot see one emerging around us.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Wages of Rebellion by Chris Hedges, performed by David DeVries. Performance copyright 2015 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.